Welcome today to our interview series, The World's Top Outstanding Professionals and Innovators. I'm Stephen Ambaraki. I am conducting an exclusive interview with Paul Niederer, CEO of the ASSOB and a world authority on equity-based crowdfunding investment. Paul is also a top innovation leader and entrepreneur. Paul, thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Now, Paul, you have an amazing history, and you've done so much worldwide and really leading the world and recognized for such. But going back from your early career, can you profile your prior top roles and useful lessons from those roles?
Yeah, well, I started off with an accountant's qualification, and that's always a very good grounding for commerce. But I didn't work as an accountant. I moved over to really marketing and did international marketing. I was based in London for a while, and Singapore and Sweden and different places. So I got to learn various systems and processes from those different countries. So that was sort of the learning from it that, as an accountant, I sort of noticed how things worked from a commercial point of view, and that was very valuable.
Now, Paul, as a world-leading authority on equity-based crowdfunding investment, can you share your top lessons of value to the audience?
Well, I think for the people, both investors, or people pledging money or investing, and then the people that are actually wanting the money, the issuers or the people with an opportunity they want money for, passion is very, very important from both sides. Like, people won't put money into an internet project unless they're passionate, and in order to get people to put money in, they have to see that you're passionate about what you're doing. But in terms of, you know, those lessons, that's one of the lessons, but then each opportunity that you're looking to raise money for, I believe, should have three important things: story, team, and followers. And the first one, story, that there is a compelling and credible story that people can follow. And so that if you were at a barbecue or something like that, and somebody said, oh, what is it that you're doing? And that story that you tell should be delivered with passion, and it should be compelling, and it should make the people want to be part of it. The second thing is team. You've got to have a balanced team. You've got to have a team that's not just technical, not like just a nerd, but you've just got to have the technical side and then the managerial side, a bit like Apple when they had Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. Steve Wozniak built the circuit boards, and Steve Jobs sold them. And the third thing is followers. You have to have a naturally aligned group of people that are willing to follow what you're doing, that like what you're doing. Like, if you've got something that nobody actually likes, you're not ever going to get any money for it. And the fifth point I'd mention is that you've got to promise what you deliver. If during the campaign you promise to deliver certain rewards or certain results, then your whole focus after you've raised the money should be on delivering.
So just as an added sort of question, because you've got so much experience that would be of value to the world, what's the sort of success rate in general when people do this kind of crowdfunding versus maybe contrast to the traditional means of fundraising?
Well, some platforms say they run around, like I think Kickstarter runs around 40% successful raises. And so I'd probably say that most platforms are in that area of 40 to 60% success. Now, relative to other ways of raising capital, the thing about this is that often people decide to raise money like this because they've been to the VCs and they've been to the angels and they've been to the banks. So really, there isn't really a relative result to other forms of finance, because this is often a last resort, although as time changes, people will move, this will become a more common form of funding, and then it will be a great deal of relativity. But at the moment, it's a way to raise money that you can't really raise money any other way.
Now, you're doing some remarkable things in Australia and feeding that throughout the world. Can you tell us more about the history and the value provided by the Australian Small Scale Offerings Board?
Yeah, we started back in 2005, and we've raised around $138 million for about 300 different small businesses. And so that's over a period of 5 years, and some of those companies have gone on to list on stock exchanges. Other ones have been sold to bigger companies, and then some of them just carry on working. And of course, in this area where it's early stage investment and it's always fairly high risk, some of them don't succeed and they just close up business. So you get a mix of different companies.
So what is your business and revenue model, and how do you differentiate from others?
Well, we've got a fairly high bar for what you call due diligence, looking at the people to see they're good people, looking at the product to see that it's got its IP protected, looking at the actual offering to see that it's being communicated fairly and in good terms and not being represented. So we charge $5,000 up front for our legal people to check all that out and make sure that when things are published that they do look good. And then from the raise, there's 8% earned on the money raised. So it's $5,000 up front, then 8% from the money raised.
You know, that sounds like an excellent value proposition to the people who are interested in using your services and your platform. So I can see why you've had so much success. Now, can you share some lessons from valuable blogs that you have in Capital Underdogs?
Yeah, well, looking at it, I think the most important thing for people to realize is that Kevin Costner was in a film which they said, build it and they will come. And, you know, he built a big baseball field in the middle of nowhere from memories. And you know, there's always the assumption that if you build something big and amazing and wonderful, then the people will turn up. And I don't believe that's the case with crowdfunding. I think that if you're raising money, you have to roll up your sleeves and you have to work hard to attract people to your profile page on whatever crowdfunding site you've got, and you attract them there so they get interested. And once they're there, you communicate with them regularly and give them updates and tell them what's going on. And after a while, more and more of those people will decide, yes, this is something to invest in or to pledge some funds to. I want to have a go at it. So it's about building a relationship with people that are interested with what you've got. And, you know, like a great example recently was a movie called Veronica Mars, a raise for a movie on Kickstarter. And what happened there was that they did 3 seasons of this show with Veronica Mars, and then it stopped. And a lot of fans were disappointed because they thought there was going to be a better ending or things were going to happen. So they went on to Kickstarter. They wanted $2 million, but they raised $5 million. But you can imagine all of the people that were fans of Veronica Mars would have sent messages out, and they kept them updated, and they had a good video. And so after a while, and in the end, instead of $2 million, they got $5.6 million. And that was really by attracting people to their site, engaging them, and communicating with them, and offering them nice things so that in the end they invested.
Well, it sounds like having quite a bit of experience or ability with social media and working all of those channels is a big benefit than when you're doing crowdfunding.
Most definitely. It's a modern way to communicate, and especially when what they talk about, this gets a bit technical, but they talk about third-level survivorship. And what that means is first level is your friends, and that's your first level. And mostly that's where your first amounts of money will come from. And then it goes to friends of friends, and that's what's called the second level. But when it gets to that third level, friends of friends of friends, that third level, if you jump over to that with your raise, if you're raising money and you manage to get people that are the friends of the friends of the friends putting money in, then you've got a very, very successful campaign. Recently, there was a 3D printer that was raised money. I think it was on Kickstarter in Singapore. And what they did was they put so much media out and so much about the 3D printer that in the end they actually jumped over their friends and their friends of friends, and they actually managed to get really good traction in that third level of friends of friends and friends and fill their raise with that. And that doesn't happen very often, but I think everybody should think about, how am I going to get that third level of people to invest in my offering?
You know, Paul, it's clear that you're a excellent communicator, because I've done a series of interviews with crowdfunding experts, and you provide such very clear messages. So how did your past experiences then lead to your work with funding and crowdfunding?
Well, I think it's that starting off as an accountant and then becoming very early on interested in the internet and internet marketing and then the systems around it. And, you know, I've had my own websites and blogs and things like that for many, many years. I started off back when CompuServe and America Online were the only ways you could really access the internet. So I guess it's just been really, really interested in any transactions that can be done over the internet that are now being done manually.
Now, what do you see as some of the essential factors for your resounding success?
Well, I think that writing blogs, supporting other people in the space, trying to become an expert in like the equity crowdfunding area, focusing on that equity crowdfunding area, and just generally communicating with people in the space, and like I am now, sharing my experiences so other people become interested and maybe some of them will contact me, and then they will go on and they will do things in the space. So really it's sharing and communicating in what I believe is a very, very important place.
You know, Paul, it's quite amazing. You know, you do travel the world because you're so highly sought after for your deep expertise and, as I mentioned, the clarity of your thinking and communication and your thought leadership. And I recently read an excerpt from I think it was from the World Bank, and I see you being listed in there as an expert in this whole space. So how will your work evolve in 5 years?
Well, I think it's early days for equity crowdfunding. So what will happen is I believe that there will be other forms. Like, it's based on a very old model where you have shares in a company and you get a share certificate, and which has become a holding statement in many jurisdictions. But, you know, when you see things like Bitcoin and electronic currencies and things, maybe in the future it's not going to be shares. But if you're crowdfunding for a share in a business, maybe you get a special colored digital coin or something like that. I think as we evolve, it'll probably move away from being trapped in securities legislation that goes back to the 1930s and become another probably less risky form of investment because of the way it's handled. I don't know what that form will be, but I think as the years go by, if the regulations in most countries still remain very tough and difficult to work around, then other forms of funding will come up. Maybe it's based on royalty streams from the businesses, or based on things that aren't actually shares in equity. So it'll be interesting to see where that evolves to.
Now, Paul, you've given us some really exciting insights as to where this could all lead. Now, from your perspective then, what is your global strategy?
Well, really just taking our platform and going into other countries and letting them use our platform to do crowdfunding there. And I think, you know, we're starting off in New Zealand probably in the next couple of months, and we've already got a platform in America that will shortly go live, so that's two countries, and then it'll just go on to other countries. You know, of course, China would be wonderful to get a platform in there, and I know those regulations have become more and more open and embracing different models, so, you know, that even China maybe.
You know, it's interesting. I speak at the ITU events on the World Summit, and I spoke at the UNESCO and also at the World Economic Forum in Astana, and there's a lot of interest in this kind of work. So let's say somebody in a country in different parts of the world wants to get involved with your platform. Do they enter into some kind of a partnership, and then is it revenue sharing?
Yeah, well, there's not a lot of margin in actually operating a platform. You can, you know, of course there is, depending if it really, really grows. But in the early days, people are very uncertain and they don't know whether it's going to work in their country. So what tends to happen is they license it or they joint venture it. And depending on the country, sometimes it might just be they have some money to license the platform and use it. Or if it's going to be difficult for them, but they are really good people with good contacts and people that are really can make a good go of it, then we might joint venture it, that they would have expertise in their country and we would have expertise in the platform. So we don't have like a price list or a fixed idea or a fixed way to do it. We just have to get a feel for each of the countries and what they're doing.
You know, I like that flexibility, and the fact that you are the pioneer in this space means a lot, because you have the experience and you can share that experience with others from around the world. So I can see a lot of success as you expand globally. Now, what are your added views for crowdfunding?
I believe that as time moves on, it will get freer and freer and further away from government regulation. I think that, you know, the sad thing in this world today is that people can go into a casino and lose all of their money and the government doesn't care. And yet if they want to bet or invest in an early stage company or some entrepreneurs, there are a whole lot of rules and regulations that stop them from doing that. And that's ridiculous, really, that because the government gets a percentage of the gambling revenue and it's good taxation for them, that they turn the blind eye to that form of gambling when they won't let people invest in small businesses, which will create growth and really grow a business. And so I think that hopefully, eventually, that you know, gambling in casinos is seen as something bad, and investing in early stage companies that will provide growth and jobs in the future is seen as something good.
Now, we've already talked about this throughout the interview, but I guess let's sort of really clarify it. Do you think that crowdfunding would just be a supplement for traditional funding approaches, or really be totally disruptive and significantly sort of replacing traditional funding approaches?
It's all really a question of scale. I don't think it'll ever replace it, because, you know, some transactions are very, very complex. And even as we see now, even if somebody wants to raise $1 million on our platform, it isn't an easy process to comply with the securities law and have all your documents right and make sure you promote them legally and things like that. So I think there's always going to be, for the larger raises, probably over $600,000-$700,000, there's going to have to be some form of intermediary or broker or dealer or somebody that holds the people's hands and makes sure they don't get into trouble, but also shows them how to do the job. Because, you know, with pledge crowdfunding and reward crowdfunding like Kickstarter and Indiegogo, it's a bit like instant gratification. You know that if you put your $100 in there, you're going to get a watch in 6 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever. And that is a fairly simple transaction. You put your money in, you get your watch. But when you invest in equities, you're investing in a company on the basis of hope. You just hope that that $20,000 you put in there is going to be looked after and it's going to grow, and then one day that you can sell those shares or the company gets sold and you get a dividend. But it's a long journey. It's a journey over years often. So to make sure that people do look after their investors, and also to make sure the investors understand what they're actually investing in, I think there is going to have to be some form of intermediary in the system to do it.
You know, Paul, that's one of the best explanations I've seen given when I asked that question. So it kind of brings to mind this idea that, you know, you do speak a lot, you have videos and so on. Is there maybe two sources that you can point to that people should look for your content?
You mean for reading? Well, what I have is I just have a Google alert for equity crowdfunding, the words equity crowdfunding and investor crowdfunding. Then every day Google alerts send me a list of 12 or 15 or 20 articles. Then I scan down them and I just pick the ones that are interesting. And I find that that's the best way for me each day to keep up with what's going on in the world.
I see. And then I guess what you do is you'll scan through what's happening in the world, and then you'll write your blogs, you'll do your presentations, you'll do videos. And so people search on your name, they get a lot of premium content because you've already filtered a lot of it for them.
That's right, yes, because I also have a blog which is more my own personal point of view at paulniederer.com, my first name and my second name. And in that one, I just wrote a blog the other day, which was a result of something that I read by a guy, Dr. Richard Swart, And he wrote something like, what he wrote was, and I said, this is an inspiring quote, and then I wrote a blog post about it, and what the quote was on paulnieder.com was, I don't believe the vast majority of people who start a crowdfunding campaign know what they're getting into. The entrepreneur or the founder has to be ready, willing, and able to commit a good chunk of energy and time to crowdfunding once they start. It's not a set and forget model. So then I wrote a blog post called Crowdfunding is Not a Set and Forget Model, and all that came from a Google alert that I wrote, because already in this interview you will have heard that I don't think that you can just sit back and hope that the people will come. You have to work with them and attract them and engage them and keep them updated. And so that's what I think is an important thing, that people realize that the most successful crowdfunding raises are the ones where people have actually worked hard to do a good job with the crowdfunding raise. Just because they've got something magical and a wonderful product, unless it gets into that what we call third level survivor, unless it goes crazy and people are begging for it, it's going to be hard work, because you've got to get people from your first level and your second level, and that means you've got to roll up your sleeves and do some work.
Well, thank you for that, Paul, and I'll definitely recommend to the audience that they seek out your website, paulnieder.com, and look at it for the blogs, because really, you are filtering what's important that people have to know.
Yes.
Now, how do you believe your prior skills contribute to your success as an entrepreneur and as a leader?
I think getting a degree is important. You know, some people think these days maybe it's not as important, but I think getting especially a commerce degree that I got, was it gave me a good understanding of business. You can't do much with it with a degree usually, but it has changed your thinking and the way you think about things, and so therefore you become interested in things relative to what you learned in your degree. So I think it's that, and then your career will follow those directions and interests that you have.
Now, you know, the world is a complex place in some respects, and we have both developed and developing nations, and something really interesting happened in August of last year, that is 2013. The China central government launched a program for financial market openness. Now, we still have to see what that ultimately will mean, but I guess it's the start of something. So if you were to kind of forecast in the future, where do you see this increasingly openness will lead and its implications?
Well, you know, I think everybody would say that the, the Chinese can be very innovative, and they work hard. Like, if you look around the world, every country has Chinese people. And what they do when they arrive there, they put their heads down, and maybe if they just begin by running restaurants and laundries and things like that, and then they go into other businesses, but they are creative and they are innovative and they're good with money and they work well. And it shows that at a fundamental level, there is a huge potential in that openness, because you allow those type of people, even within their own country, to work out better ways of doing things, to be more productive and to be more innovative and provide solutions. So I believe that openness will bring better opportunities for people to start businesses and grow businesses, because with things like crowdfunding, other people will say, well, good on you, what a great idea, I'd like to put some money into that, and that will grow the Chinese economy. And instead of being dependent on always making things for other countries, then there will be things that will be designed and grown in China and funded through crowdfunding in China. So that would grow businesses in their own country, because it's not often that people will invest from overseas into Chinese crowdfunding projects. It will have to be Chinese investing in crowdfunding projects that are going to be beneficial for China and the Chinese people. So I think that openness will bring that type of success.
Now, earlier I alluded to the World Bank report, and they talk about crowdfunding, and in fact, as I mentioned, you, Paul Nieder, are cited within that report as a leader and pioneer in this area, but I believe there's a portion of the report where they talked about sort of the market opportunity in China for crowdfunding is over 95 billion, or for the region is $95 billion of which China will have something like 50 billion of it. So it does indicate that there's some opportunity there. And as you mentioned, the Chinese have a sort of a history of entrepreneurship and education and seeking knowledge, and that economy is transforming into a knowledge economy. So it'll be interesting to see where this all leads.
Definitely.
Now, on this next question, you know, what do you see should be the investment or government policy changes that you want to see implemented in your country and then perhaps worldwide?
Well, I think it goes back to what's called personal responsibility. Unfortunately, you can't regulate or write laws for every single situation. But I believe, especially if the investment amounts are relatively low, like $1,000 or $5,000, as long as the person investing has been absolutely clearly been shown that this is a very risky investment, you may lose all your money, you may not get your money back. If they've signed to that effect, that they recognize that and they're investing on that basis, then I think that regulation should follow that path. And we're fortunate in Australia that the regulations are written like that, whereby provided the people have had sufficient warnings and they have through an action that they've said, yes, I agree, this is risky, and yes, I might lose all my money, but I'm still going to invest, then you're allowed to carry on with the investment. But I think the way the America's going is they're more saying, well, you can't invest more than 10% of your income and you can't do this and you can't do that. They're trying to make regulations to protect the people investing, but they're not giving them the responsibility to invest. And then what happens is, if you do it that way, then people can sue the company that's raising money and things, because the responsibility is with the state and the legal system and not with the individual people that have actually put their money into an opportunity. And, you know, if you look at gambling again, if somebody loses all their money in gambling, nobody blames the gambling company. They don't sort of say to the casino, oh, you're naughty for that person losing $100,000. So, you know, we've got a double standard or a double moral here. And I think that at least if you're investing, you can sign on a piece of paper that, oh, I recognize I could lose all my money and I'm willing to invest my money on that basis.
You know, it's interesting. You mention or reference the U.S. and I guess the Jumpstart or Business Startups or Jobs Act, which was initiated in, I guess, April 2012. And then there's Title III policy coming into effect April of this year. That is 2014. So it's interesting that, you know, what would be the implications of that? And maybe there's just too much regulation in there or too many restrictions in there to freely open up the market. I guess it's going to be a topic of debate and the world will be watching. And it's interesting that you have spotlighted that as well, because you are a world leading authority, and I think people should listen to your point of view because you've got so many years of experience in this area. Now, as I mentioned earlier, you know, you are this acknowledged expert. You're speaking often, quoted often, and so on. From all your speaking travels and work, do you have any interesting stories to share? Maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Well, what I have is, I recently spoke in Durban in South Africa to a lot of small businesses, and I was talking about crowdfunding and how it worked and everything, and there was this gentleman stood up in the audience when it was question time, and he said, well, that's all very fine for you people living in the Western world, but this is not applicable to us. And so, of course, the audience sits there and they wonder what I'm going to say. And then I said, well, look, I tell you what, this morning I was reading the paper and I was reading about the rhinoceroses and how the Koreans are coming and buying the horns of the rhinoceros because they make them very potent. And so they're paying to kill these rhinoceroses and take them back to Korea. And I said, well, what a wonderful thing to have a crowdfunding campaign, to have a crowdfunder, a movie about this, so that you can show all the wives of all the Korean men how silly they are, and crowdfund a movie that points out that how bad this is, that they kill the rhinoceroses, and how it's not a good thing and everything like that. And of course then everybody clapped because they thought, yes, that is a crowdfunding thing that we could do here in Africa and around the world to show people that that killing all these rhinoceroses is a silly thing based on an old superstition that's got no proof at all. So that was the first one. And then another one was I was living in Singapore about 30 years ago, and Singapore's temperature is always around about 30 degrees, and I had to go to Beijing for a couple of meetings, and so I just went out to the airport and got on the plane, and then when I landed there in Beijing, it was freezing cold, and I had no coat or anything. So in those days, there weren't many Western shops 30 years ago. So what I had to do is I had to go to an army shop, and I had to buy a big army coat so that I could keep warm. And I always think that is a good memory. And the third one really is that sometimes when people come in to raise money and they want to do crowdfunding, sometimes they just score 10 out of 10. They've got a great story and a great team, and they've got lots of followers. And you get a really good feeling when they come in and you know that they got 10 out of 10 for story, 10 out of 10 for followers, and 10 out of 10 for the team. And you just think, wow. And often you're right. Often you see that those ones do raise the money. So for any of the people listening, if they think about it and say, right, is my story 10 out of 10? Is it compelling and credible? Or have I got a team that people look at with respect and think, yes, this team can do a great job? And then thirdly, have I got a lot of people that naturally will like this particular thing, like the 3D printer? There were lots of technical people out there that thought, wow, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could have my own 3D printer? So then you had a lot of followers. And so if you have those three things, then you're going to be pretty certain you can have a good crowdfunding campaign.
You know, those are some fascinating stories and brought a smile to my face, I should mention. And again, the three pillars of successful crowdfunding. I think they're just such very distinctive and interesting and easy to remember ideas, right, as you launch your campaign. Now we're down to our last question, and this is where I turn the tables and I kind of make it open-ended. And I do it this way. I say, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Oh, well, that's a good question. Well, first of all, I'd say really, well, Paul, can you tell me what it takes to truly succeed in crowdfunding? And I think having the great story, great team, great followers, and then having the passion and energy and drive so that it's not set and forget. You're involved right up until the time where you have to deliver value to the people. And I think that's what, it all comes back to energy. And then I think, why should you do it? Why should you do crowdfunding? Well, I think it's because it betters this world. It brings new products. It brings new opportunities. It brings things to people that wouldn't normally be able to come forward and be developed. And we've had lots of listings on our platform where people have raised money that there was no chance that they would have got their money from anywhere else until they came onto the AdSob platform. And then the other thing in terms, I'd probably say, well, what sort of things should you crowdfund? And well, really, you can say the story team follower thing, but the thing is, it's got to be something that people look at it and think that that's something that I would like or I would like to be part of. And you've just got to communicate it so that whether it be the Veronica Mars film where people thought, wow, I can't wait, I'd love to see that movie, or it's a 3D printer, I'd love to have that 3D printer. It might be like some of our raisers in our platform, like a portal where people could do their pensions. Or it might be some spray-on skin that hides red skin that doesn't look so good. There's so many different things, but the type of things that you can crowdfund are things that people can communicate and that they would like to have in their life or be part of their life, and that's what people get passionate about.
Well, thank you so much for that, Paul, and I know your schedule is very demanding because you're in such high demand, so we are indeed fortunate to have you come in and do this interview. And thank you for sharing your many deep experiences with our audience.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it. And thanks for having such insightful questions.
Well, Paul, it was a real pleasure. And I'm going to close by saying I am Stephen Ibaraki. And this concludes our exclusive interview with Paul Niederer, CEO of the ASSOB And Paul is a world authority on equity-based crowdfunding investment, and he is a top innovation leader and entrepreneur.